This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
First of all, I don't accept that all lives are of equal value. My children's and my grandchildren's life is worth much more than mine because they've got a lot more of it ahead. The whole concept of quality life years ahead is absolutely fundamental if one's going to look at the value of these things.
That's Lord Sumption last week talking about why a lockdown harms everyone whilst isolation of the most vulnerable is a better way. And, you know, if those people die, well, they're of less value than the young. Is he right on that? We keep on hearing from some quarters that lockdowns are a cure worse than the disease itself, in particular in relation to the damage it's doing to the economy. But death is real. The economy is something that mankind has cooked up. So is he right to set one up against the other? And is he right that some lives are worth more than others? I'm Phil Dobby. We'll look at that today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. Welcome along. So, Steve, the attitude of some over this whole COVID-19 thing is that we should just shield the old and let everyone else work so that the economy doesn't suffer. And look, if a few old die as a result of that, that's just the price we have to pay because at least it's keeping the economy ticking over. And of course, it is mainly the old who've died from COVID-19. So let's take the position of this group of people who have this view. Let's call them the cold, heartless bastards.
That's a good value-free title. Yeah, that'll do as a description.
Yeah, well, yeah, it is value. I'm not saying they are cold, heartless bastards. I'm just calling them in this situation a group of, let's call them actors that we will define as cold, heartless bastards. They say, you know, we shouldn't isolate because the over 60s are holding back the economy. So have they got a point on that?
I mean, if you wanted to sit down and do a calculation, which first of all, if assumption number one, let's assume people over that age, over whatever age we're talking about, aren't human anymore. That's always an important part of the sort of economic calculus. And then you say, if we don't actually have to spend money on them, we can spend it on, you know, more relevant stuff today, like, you know, fireworks. And it certainly is.
Eat more avocado on toast, for example.
Yeah, it's dehumanizing. And that is probably what I find most repulsive about the whole thing, that these people who are talking about rational calculation are leaving out the essence of humanity itself and being so-called rational, while at the same time, and I'd love to do a Venn diagram of those people, you know, a complete one. You know, here are three circles. Where do you stand? Because they seem to be so-called pro-life, so that means they're anti-abortion. They're also pro the death penalty. And here, now they're coming along and saying that we shouldn't worry about old people dying because they're old. The capacity to hold, you know, antagonistic attitude. I'm pro-life. That's why I'm in favor of old people dying of COVID.
But it is a bit bizarre, isn't it? Look, the reason why I thought we should cover this today was because this week Lord Sumption, who is a
Sumption. Yeah. Sumptuous. Okay.
He leads a sumptuous life, I think, and makes lots of assumptions maybe when he's there because he's been a former Supreme Court judge. He was on a BBC TV show this week. This is a bit of a worry that this is the sort of people who are making judgment calls. But he was talking about the value of human life. He just said it's a fact that older people are worth less. They have less value because they have less to live. And he was talking about that in relation to lockdowns and the impact on the economy, but also arguing over, you know, who should and who shouldn't get vaccines. And unfortunately, he was getting questioned by a stage four cancer patient who asked whether her life was less valuable than someone who was perfectly healthy, to which he didn't give a direct answer, but you could tell the answer, as far as he was concerned, was yes. So, you know, what a shame. If someone over 70 dies, or someone with a terminal illness dies before their time, if it means everyone else can go to work, that's going to be good for the economy. I mean, that's the argument, isn't it?
Yeah, well, to me, it's just we're seeing some classic instances of what it means to have a market-oriented way of thinking about humanity. Because this is all dependent upon us being in a capitalist economy where you try to put a monetary price upon virtually everything. Mm. If you imagine if we were back in the Kalahari Desert or on the Rift Valley or that's sort of early Cro-Magnon society. Your elders were the ones who knew everything. And it was a great tragedy when one of the elders went because their knowledge was lost. Mm. And that respect for the seniors was a, if you look at, say, what is more fundamental in human society, is it valuing a group on the basis of their contribution to the economy or valuing wisdom? And clearly there's no wisdom in the valuations these people are making. There are so many elements to this because, you know, you better interrupt me as often as you like, because I can rave on this one for quite a while.
No, but I like the direction you're going, because the value that we place on older employees is an example of that, isn't it? That, you know, once you're over 40, you're over the hill. Lots of companies would rather hire a 20-something, whereas the over 40s got, or something, you know, the over 50s have got so much more knowledge that they could impart. And, okay, there's the assumption that a lot of it is out-of-date knowledge, but there's a lot of things that just don't go out of date.
Well,
it's wisdom that you mentioned.
That turned up on the financial markets, because by the time we had the 2000 stock market bubble, everybody who experienced the 87 stock market crash wasn't there anymore. If you'd had the wisdom of ages and keep people who experienced 1929 and 1966, which is the beginning of breakdowns, 1973 and 1982 and 1987, those years together, and so here we go again. I've seen this one before. Yeah. I know where this one ends, and you would therefore potentially not have had the bubble in the first place. So this lack of this focus upon youth and the ignorance of wisdom is a major part of why we end up having so many calamities caused by the lack of wisdom.
But Lord Sumption's point was that, you know, this Lord idea Sumption. Of placing his assumption from Lord Sumptuous was that, you know, the value of human life is a well-known economic calculation, and it's used all the time. It's used in health circles, for example, and it's just a fact of life that's the way we deal with the numbers.
Well, the funny thing is, I can criticize that, but at the same time, one important point from David Graeber's work was that when he looked back and tried to see what was actually the basis of the origins of money, it was more people putting value on a human life which had been taken and saying this much money is relevant to compensation for taking that person's life. So in a bizarre sort of way, the beginnings of the monetary economy began with putting a monetary value on life. And in that sense, our Lord Sumptuous is in keeping with the long tradition of reducing humanity to a monetary valuation.
Right. Well, when you were taking someone out,
you'd already taken them out. I mean, right. it wasn't exactly a friendly time for humanity in general. But if you see what the Sumerians treated some of their conquered nations. But the valuation was there. That's how much you've taken. Give us that much back, and that's compensation for having killed so and so.
Right. Okay. So you'd get more for. I'm not implying this at all. This is going down a very dark road.
Dark,
you get more.
Yeah.
You'd get more for killing Lord Sumption than you would the stage 4 cancer.
Hey, now there's a bargain. Maybe we should suggest it to him. I'm sure at a reasonable price, it could be an offer too good to refuse.
Yes, given that we've now placed an economic value on you. Well, I mean, there's the thing as well. You know, if you are killing people, do you get less of a prison sentence if you kill someone who's old and therefore was of lesser value to society?
Mm-hmm. And maybe you get paid after a certain age level. You know, yeah.
I mean, very dark road.
I mean, I wanted to take this back to where we began as humans, and that's why I made the point about the elders, that we used to value the elders. The elders were the ones that had wisdom of the, and that wisdom was something that's precious to be maintained, but you also had respect for the person. In some ways, having survived what it took to stay alive to reach old age at that time. So there was a degree, sense of respect and cohesion, and we've lost that completely and replaced it by a dollar valuation. And now you get this nonsense of, you know, trying to say that we should not worry about the old dying because, hey, they're old. That was not exactly how our... You know, the original humans would have considered the topic. In fact, the person who said that, the young one, would probably be a part of a sumptuous feast right now, but not with his mouth open.
But
possibly with an apple.
An apple in his mouth. That's right. But I mean, we spend about £100 billion on state pensions in the UK, which is about 5% of GDP. Most pensioners, the most you can get is £175 a week, and that's actually calculated on how long you've been paying. I know. And that's calculated on how much you've been paying. That's the most. That's based on how much you've been paying on national insurance. So if, like me, you've returned to the UK after a fairly long absence, I'm not going to get very much. I'm going to basically live off berries and food banks unless I can keep podcasting till the day I die, which I might have to do. Watch me gradually become more senile. I think it's already started. So, but £175, you're going to spend all of that. So there's, you know, and you know, you presumably have got some money wrapped up that you've saved in other ways as well. I mean, then, and look, if that's money that's been pumped into the economy from the government overspending their budget, then we know that that's new money. So that the fact those old people are there, they are a useful vehicle of transmission for money into the broader economy, aren't they? So they're actually doing some good.
They're actually have reason to have money created. So they're a form of additional demand. Because there's no problem in producing output in capitalism. That's of course not factoring the next thing we're going to face, which is global warming pushing us right backwards. But while we're ignoring the global constraints, there's nothing stopping us using more capacity, except an absence of demand. And in some sense, by being people who demand without producing, they're part of the aggregate demand system that keeps the rest of the economy working. So getting rid of them might actually cause a recession.
Yeah. So there is no cost, really. You know, when you look at it like that, there's really no cost in having old people who are claiming a state pension.
Well, I mean, it's the same argument in favour of having young people's education paid for by the state. It's a way in which the government can create money without raising any issues about whether it's distorting the economy or doing something the private sector should do. That's where I'd rather see, you know, the state's capacity to create money being directed, things like that. Health, obviously, being the other one, which is, you know, I think anybody who argues for private health has had their argument shot out beneath them by COVID already. But certainly education and aged care, those are classic reasons why the government should simply provide the money, and that's the way that it provides the deficit that gives the rest of us money that enables capitalism to tick over.
Yeah.
I don't think Mr. Sumptuous has thought that. Mr. Sumptuous, should we just demote him rather than, you know, putting an apple in his mouth?
So there's going to be more old people as well, obviously. We've got an ageing population in the UK, so a higher ratio. There's 12 million people of pension age in the UK right now. That's about a quarter of the size of the working age population, so a ratio of 1 to 4. By 2030, that ratio is going to be... 1 to 3.4, by 2040 it's going to be 1 to 2.9. So it's a much higher proportion of the population are going to be of pension age. So, if we feel like that's a problem, I mean, this is an argument that's got to be had, hasn't it? The one that we've just had, pointing out, well, no, actually, they're still consumers, and that's important.
Yeah, I mean, but the other issue as well as the pressure we're putting on the planet overall. And that, like, it's what I said, it's such a complicated issue, because I go right back and say we are dehumanizing to even have this discussion compared to what original human societies were like. And they must be the standard on which we judge ourselves, I think. You look now and say, well, it's ludicrous in terms of a macroeconomic thing. You think that's a good idea, because what you're doing is cutting out part of aggregate demand when the problem is insufficient aggregate demand. So it's again a short-term micro-orientation that's wrong to be used in the context of thing which is decidedly macro. But the other thing is, we have got an enormous pressure of humanity on the planet. There are too many of us, and we are going to be forced, I believe, to reduce population. I don't think there's any possibility of reaching the type of predictions people have of 10 billion humans. I think we're going to go backwards. In that process, There is no easy way to talk about it.
But I mean, even in the short term, you made the point that those same people who are probably saying that, well, you know, if the old people die, the old people die, the same people are saying that there should be a right to life, so we should have more young people being born because we shouldn't allow abortion.
Yeah, and more almost like the climate change deniers as well. I don't mind casting aspersions on somebody whose last name is Sumptuous, I must say.
So there's going to be a change in spending habits as well, because older people spend less eating out, less on clothing, less on doing the house up. They spend more on health. I mean, this has got to be, obviously, if we, you know, we have to look and say, well, okay, the makeup of the demands from the population, this aggregate demand, is that the makeup of that is going to change, because, there's going to be a higher proportion of spending on health from this aging population.
Yeah. It's not going to happen. I mean, we know that they're not going to be locking up the nursing homes, letting anybody inside them die, which is the logical extension of what Sumptuous is saying.
Are a lot of people talking that way? I don't know. I just think if this carries on, and you know, who knows how long COVID-19 is going to be with us for? Mm. I suspect we're going to be where we are now for quite a chunk of this year, even with the vaccine. The UK, which never locked anything down at all in terms of people coming into the country, all of a sudden now is talking about putting people in hotels for a couple of weeks if they arrive and having had a positive test before they leave the country that they're coming from. In a country where you could just waltz in until a week ago. You can't help feeling, well, that's a sudden change in attitude, which must mean that they've got concerns over other strains of the virus not working with the vaccines that are being rolled out in this country.
Or the level of the main one, that would be B.1.1.7 variant, is as dramatic an increase in transmissibility as they thought, and that's why they're getting news back from the NHS being totally overwhelmed by the numbers growing as fast as they are.
Yeah, so we had the biggest number for deaths yesterday as well.
That's over 3,000, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't that much. It's 1,600, but in a day.
When you make a comparable one for America, that's 10,000 a day in terms of comparing it to America's population. When America's currently running at about 2,000, and America's a disaster.
Yeah, so no, UK's doing worse. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, well, my God.
UK now actually, I think, has the highest number of deaths per head of population in the world. But look, the argument that's given, even this, the poster child or the poster city for the people who were for herd immunity was Manaus in Brazil. Which had very little in the way of assistance during the first wave of the virus. It was unchecked, basically, and it killed 500,000 people in the before it reached herd immunity, and then the infection stopped because everyone said, well, we've reached herd immunity in Manaus. There we are. Now we know the point. Basically, 1 in 500 people. When 1 in 500 people will die, and then it'll be over with. Let's look at Manaus. That's all we need to put up with. 1 in 500. Oh, is that acceptable? Which actually, is not too far away from where the UK is heading right now. So if that is the case, you'd say, well, okay, cool. Maybe we don't need to lock down. We'll just reach herd immunity and get on with our lives. But only 6% of the population of Manaus are aged over 60, and 90% of the UK deaths so far are over 60. And 23% of the UK population is aged over 60. So if you put all of that together, 1 in 500 deaths for a city of Manaus, which is 2 million, that means 4,000 deaths. If you look at that and you look at the UK population, which is 16.5 million are over 60. So in Manaus, 120,000 are over 60. So that would mean 3,600 deaths to get your 1 in, would actually be 1 in 33 deaths in Manaus. So in the UK, 1 in 33 deaths in the over 60s, with where 16.5 million people are over 60, would mean 500,000 deaths. Would we be happy with having 500,000 people dying in the UK before we reached herd immunity? Seems like a rather large number, doesn't it?
Yeah. And Yeah, I mean, it is a bizarre twist of this particular virus that it knocks off the old rather than the young, because, of course, the Spanish flu was the other way around. It killed more young people than the First World War did.
Well, so then there's the thing, and they were an economic productive age, so so people would be arguing that that was a bigger concern because it was killing people who were impacting the economy, whereas, you know, if we assume that old age pensioners don't contribute anything, so then less of an impact. But look, the interesting thing about Manaus is that it didn't reach herd immunity. There's a second part to this story, which is comes as no surprise. You know, the virus has returned now to Manaus. It's rifling through the population. The hospitals, like they are in the UK, are over capacity. They are having to fly in oxygen to the hospitals. They're taking people out of Manaus to get treated in other places. So there is no herd immunity, basically. They thought they'd reached it, but the second wave has come, and it's come back to bite them with a vengeance, and it's worse than the first time. So
I've been told by some friends of mine in medical circles that herd immunity has never been achieved except by a vaccine. So the whole thing you could do through the disease itself was wrong to begin with.
Yeah. So what happens if we do go through this for a long time then? How does the attitude change, not just to old-age pensioners, but generally? I mean, the government will just have to keep on pumping in more and more money into the economy. Already we're seeing politicians trying to backtrack on spending. I mean, already we've got the Chancellor in the UK talking about how he's going to have to tax more, starting with corporate taxes because he doesn't want to necessarily push up tax on individuals. And then there's obviously going to be spending cuts as well. All the stuff that, you know, makes no sense for an economy that's trying to recover. But that's just going to get worse and worse. If we went through another year of this with more spending and absolutely no conversations being held about writing off debt.
That's why I would like to take this whole discussion back to the issue of how did Europe and England in particular fight the Second World War? And the answer was it paid for it by running a deficit. When you take a look at the numbers that are involved, the whole vision that the public sector has to borrow from the private sector to pay for government deficits is total nonsense, because they didn't suddenly find 40% of GDP worth of extra money in 1 year, but that was the scale of the government deficit in 1940. Similar thing for America in 1942, its deficit was 30% of GDP. And when you look at how do they find the money to pay for 30% of GDP worth of bonds, it was created by the deficit. This is why the points that modern monetary theory makes are so vitally important, because we're seeing constraints that simply don't exist. And they flow again from not understanding the accounting of banking. And so if we end up doing this as well, imposing austerity, pardon me, on top of the damage that the virus itself has done to productive capacity and demand as well, you're asking for social breakdown out of this, which is unnecessary. It is simply bad policy.
So how did we cope in situations like this when currencies were tied to the supply of currency and the value of currency was tied to the gold standard? And I think we just ignored it. We just ignored it, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, there was never a physical gold involved in any of those so-called gold-based currencies. The only time gold turned up in any dramatic sense as a currency was international trade, where you didn't have before you had the acceptance of paying money, say, in English pounds and things of that nature. So when the fiat system didn't work, then gold and silver were used for international transactions. And when you had periods like the 30 Years' War or the 100 Years' War in Europe, when there was no guarantee the king you were fighting for was going to survive, you, as a mercenary, demanded payment in gold or silver. So whichever way the battle went, you still were financial the day after. So the idea that those things were a limit is just false.
Right. But, I mean, so when we were tied to the gold standard, the amount of money that was, the amount of US dollars that was in circulation wasn't restricted by the availability of gold. It was it was just tied to the value of gold.
Yeah, yeah. So you could buy gold, you know, under the Bretton Woods, you could buy gold at $35 an ounce, but there was no way that the amount of gold controlled how much money could be created. And this is where some of the tensions have got involved and led to its breakdown anyway.
Yeah, because there was too much money, and therefore it was easy. So much money you could use it to buy the gold, all of the gold that was in existence, which is what the French tried to do.
And it wasn't just the government creating money, it was the private banking sector as well, which is left out of their thinking too.
Right. So, okay, so do we – at what point if we went through, another year or even another 2 years of this, spending at the rate we are now – the government overspends to a very large amount. There's a lot more money which is being pumped into the economy to make it survive. So is there actually that much more money being pumped into the economy? Because there's no, if government money is being spent to pay people that are inactive because they can't do their jobs, I guess there's more money. It's just not circulating very fast.
Yeah, there's much stock of money in that sense. I mean,
the circulation has stopped to basically almost zero.
Not quite zero, but it's
a fraction.
Yeah. But it could be, in some ways that could actually fix up the important imbalance in the monetary system. That's too much private debt because, again, this happened during the Second World War as well. As the government was just pumping money into the armament system, without which it wouldn't have beaten the Germans, who beat them to it, by the way, by understanding monetary creation about a decade ahead of England's own experiment with it. That money creation financed the war, and it also meant that the private sector had nothing to spend its money on apart from basic rations and so on. And so in that process, the private sector saved money and paid its debt down without causing a recession. This one side effect, this amount of government money creation, could be the sort of accidental jubilee that I always thought would come in the aftermath to a financial crisis. It may come in the aftermath to COVID.
Right. So people pay off the debts that they owe. So when we come out the other side, but when they're not holding so much debt, so they've got the ability to spend.
And you also have if more government money creation, there's more government money to circulate. That itself.
Hence the fears of inflation at that point, though, isn't it? That if there's so much that happened, you've got such a big increase in the money supply, and people can, and then the moment that starts circulating, then you've got then the economy's running hot.
Well, but the other thing, of course, is that calculus leaves out the role of private debt and the fact that people may use that money to pay their debt down because they've got nothing else to do with it. The worry that I see is that a lot of this, particularly in Australia, and I think we're seeing this in Canada and also, I believe, even the UK and America, a house price is going runaway again. So people are using their money to go back and speculate on financial assets once more. And you think, that is the suicidal alternative. It's a time to be reducing the gearing of the private sector, not increasing it. But that's, unfortunately, seems to be the way some of that money is being used.
Well, did you see there was an RBA report which was uncovered, I think, by the AFR, the Australian Financial Review, obviously a top secret report they didn't want anyone to see, that was speculating that, in fact, house prices in Australia, if interest rates continued to be low, could go up by 30% in the next few years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they know. They just don't know what to do about it because they don't want to push interest rates up. They're between a rock and a hard place. I don't know how you fix that problem. What would they? I mean, we're going off where we started on all of this, but it's an interesting discussion. How do they fix that?
Well, I mean, this is what we haven't fixed. We don't. The money hasn't been used to get ready for a not just a post-COVID world, but a post-climate change world. If you're going to find that out, trade lines can no longer be as long as they were, you can no longer have overseas production, you need to have it domestically, then that requires factories, which we haven't built. Bubble economies haven't. So you're going to have expensive house prices but no productive capacity when you're going to need that productive capacity desperately. So I see it as something which can work until it fails tragically. And that's a bit the same way that minimizing public costs by not preparing for a pandemic fails tragically when you have a pandemic.
Could you fix it with differential interest rates? Could you say, well, okay, if you want to get a home loan, you're going to have to pay a lot more than if you're going to borrow money to invest in building a factory?
No, yeah, you could, but I think that's another topic. Maybe we better get back to
another day. Exactly. Let's get back to the old people then, very quickly, to round off. Let's at least finish where we started. Mm. If old people are getting £175 a week, and it's if we follow the monetary theory line that if it's all extra money that the government wouldn't have otherwise spent if those people hadn't existed, why not give them £350 a week? I mean, they will spend £350 a week. They've got nothing else to do with it. And that's all good for the economy. They've got the time to spend it. Why are we limiting how much money we give to old people who have a who are a very useful vehicle? Actually, got a lot of value, Lord Sumption, because they can, you know, because they're out shopping. Why not double it so they double the input into the economy?
It's the whole supply side focus of mainstream economic thinking when the weaknesses in capitalism are on the demand side. And what you're giving money to students, giving money to old people, giving money to hospitals is all a way of creating the money that the rest of us use in the private sector. And the less you do it, the less well the private sector works, not the better.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there because that is a very easy to understand point to finish off on. We should.
Oh, we can't have that.
I know. Think demand, not supply. I like it. Okay. Good talk, Steve. Catch you again next week.
Okay, mate. Bye.
And next time, we are going to look at the supposed independence of central banks. They, of course, aren't that independent anymore. Through this crisis, they have colluded with governments to try and get some sort of coordination about how best to get money to get the economy working again. So can central banks ever be independent ever again? And should they? And what should be the division of the work between the Treasury and central banks? We'll look at all of that next time on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen and Phil Dobby. I'll be back next week too. See you then.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.